And we're holding on Samach Vav Amud Beis, two lines from the bottom. We learned yesterday a story involving Nachdimon Ben Gurion's daughter. So Nachdimon Ben Gurion, we know, was one of the famous three rich people in Yerushalayim before the Churban. We know we have the story in Gittin where he and two others offered to supply the city with food and wood and everything else that they need to last 21-year siege. In the end, the Biryonim went and burnt their storehouses of food, and that's when you had the horrors of the siege of Yerushalayim. So here we're saying Nachdimon Ben Gurion's daughter, originally her father, of course, being extremely rich, and she married into a rich family as well. Her ksuba had been an enormous amount. It had been just the part that her father was giving as a dowry was 1,000,000 gold dinars, where a gold dinar is 25 silver dinar. So you're talking an enormous amount of money. To put it in perspective, a person in those days, an average of a simple person, could usually live on 200 dinar, or 200 silver dinar, that is, a year. Then the Gemara says that after the Churban, this same girl was instead reduced so far down, she was so poor, that she was having to go among the animals of the Arabs who were grazing their animals around the ruins of Yerushalayim and look for undigested kernels of grain in their waste. So she was talking with Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai and explained to him the reason why, how she was matzik aleihas adin. She knew this is not just a random thing. So when Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai asked what happened to your father's money, she said because he didn't give tzedakah like the way he was supposed to. So the question is, Nachdimon ben Gurion like Ovid tzedakah? So you're telling me Nachdimon ben Gurion did not do tzedakah? That should happen, therefore, that all of his wealth was lost like that, and his daughter was reduced to this very low state. Well, Tani, we learn in a brayso, Omru all of al Nachdimon ben Gurion. They said about Nachdimon ben Gurion, the same one, when he would leave his house to go to the Beis Medrash, clay melas hoyimatsiyin tachtav, they would spread out carpets. Melas is a kind of fine wool, so they would spread out carpets of fine wool on the ground so that he could walk on those instead of on the bare ground. And then the poor people would come and roll them up behind him, and then they'd have these very expensive carpets which had just barely been used, and they could keep them and they could sell them. So he was giving quite a bit of stuff. So the Gemara answer is, Iboris emel chvoidu hu da'avad. One answer is, yes, he gave tzedakah, but he was doing it for his own cover. Because he was doing it in this way, that people should see that he's a great Baal tzedakah, and maybe also it was even that the arrangement was something like the poor people will spread them out in front of him, and then those same poor people are entitled to take it. So it was done for his kavod, and therefore that doesn't have the same effect that we said before, that the Gemara had said, that tzedakah preserves a person's money. Now, Marsha points out, the fact is, I mean, we know when a person does mitzvahs, even if they do them shaloi l'shma, then it's still something. But tzedakah in particular, a person can do shaloi l'shma. But Marsha says here he was doing it for his own kavod, so therefore that's worse. Shaloi l'shma would be, for example, the Gemara talks about elsewhere, let's say a person gives tzedakah in order that his children should live and be healthy, or so they should have a place in Olam Haba. It's not doing it purely l'shma, but nevertheless, it is shaloi l'shma, but still it's not so bad. But here he's doing it for his kavod, then Marsha says that might be worse. In fact, Marsha, editorializes over here. Sometimes he does that in his Chidushim and Agadas. Sometimes he has occasion to point out things where he sees that the people in his times are falling down on something, and he sees. He describes over here in his times, this is, we're talking late 15, early 1600s, we're talking about, he says, many people who collect wealth dishonestly, involving Chilul Hashem, for example, stealing from Goyim, then they take that money and they pledge it publicly to make Mishaberas for them in Shul, or other things like that. So he says it's a mitzvah baba veda, first of all, the money came to them dishonestly. And certainly you can't say that because they're giving tzedakah with it, it should be preserved, because you have the same problem as we're saying with Nachdimon Ben Gurion over here, where they're doing it for their kavod rather than with any thought of the mitzvah. So that's one explanation. There's a couple of other explanations, one of them being an interesting one from the Chofetz Chaim, which in turn is brought by the Kovetz Shiurim, by Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who says, Hayad, who says that maybe in normal times, even this lesser schos of tzedakah would have been enough to protect his wealth. But because the Churban, of course, was a time of tremendous outpouring of Hashem's anger against the Jewish people, so then at that time you need greater schosim, and Nachman Ben Gurion lacked it, was saying, because he did tzedakah in this way, having in mind his kavod rather than having in mind the mitzvah. By the way, so yesterday, Eli, you mentioned, what about Nachman Ben Gurion? This is the same one with the 12 wells of water and so forth. Well, in that story, actually, in the story where he goes to the Roman and offers him, either I'll give you back rain for your 12 wells, or I'll pay you 12 kicker of silver. The fact is, he didn't end up paying. And in fact, he went to the Bais Hamikdash and davened that a nest should happen, so he shouldn't have to pay. So maybe that also fits in with this. I mean, ultimately, even if he had paid, I don't know if it would be considered tzedakah, considering he's not giving it directly to the aniyim, he's paying it to the Roman on behalf of that the Jews should have water. Maybe that might not have been considered anyway, but in the event, he didn't actually even end up paying anything. And the Gemara does say over there, by the way, that he himself said in that story that he wasn't doing it for his own covering. Nevertheless, in other words, there can still be, there can be layers and layers of motivation that a person has in something, and underneath it all, there might be a slight thing of covered. So actually says Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, one of the Balei Amusar, in one of his talks on this subject. Anyway, Rav Yaakov Emden points out, even we have what we said over there, Hashem did a nest for him, he's beloved by Hashem, but we know Hashem treats those who are beloved by him, the tzaddikim, much more strictly. So therefore, so the result of that is what we're saying in the Gemara over here, that he ended up losing all his wealth, and his daughter was reduced to the state that we were saying. That's one answer, the Gemara says. The boy same. Another answer, you could say, even if you say that he did this tzedakah with the carpets, l'shem shamayim, and not for his own covered, still compared to the amount of wealth that it has, that he had, it wasn't enough. He could have done more. As people say, according to the load, as the camel, the stronger the camel, the more you can load on it. So in other words, Nachman Ben Gurion, having been so fabulously rich, he was expected to give more tzedakah than just these carpets. Obviously, he must have given other tzedakah as well, but still the Gemara is saying the possibility is that maybe he didn't give enough as would have befitted somebody of his amount of wealth. And the Gemara continues, Tanya, Omer of Elazar ben Tzadik. So it's not only, so we had before in the story that Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai saw her like that, this girl, Nachman ben Gurion's daughter, collecting grain from among the waste of the animals. So now Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadik says the same thing. He says, Ere ben Nechama, may I see the Nechama, which Rashi elsewhere, as Gemara, this expression is used in other places in Shas, Rashi in Makkos explains two possibilities. One is that it really means that he's going to swear and say if such and such is not true, then I should not see the Nechama, meaning the Nechama of the Jewish people, that I should not get to see Mashiach. And so it's a way of swearing. In other words, I'm certain that what I'm saying, the following statement that I'm saying and that I'm swearing to is true, and the Gemara just left out the word loy because it would rather talk in a positive way. Or the other possibility, it actually says Nechama, would mean the kind of nechama that a person gets after his children, Rahman al-Tlan, pass away. So he's saying, as a Lashon of a Shura, may I see the nechama, in other words, may I have to sit shiva for my children, if such and such is not true. Again, a way of saying, I'm telling you 100% for sure that this is true, and that I can swear to it. And he says, in loyda isiva, that if I did not see, meaning I most certainly saw, this same girl, Nachman Ben Gurion's daughter, she was collecting barley from between the hooves of the horses in Akai. So the previous story was Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai saw her outside the ruins of Yerushalayim collecting barley from among the dung of the animals of the Arabs. Now she was in Akko in the north of Eretz Yisrael, and there also she was collecting barley from among the hooves of the horses over there. Karosi alei mikrazeh. And Rabbi Elazar ben Tzadik says, I realize the following pasuk applies to her. The pasuk says, Im loy sevi lo hayofa banoshim. The pasuk in Shirat Shirim says, if you don't know for yourself, most beautiful of women, we're the most beautiful of women in Shirat Shirim, who's being addressed as the Jewish people, who are the most beautiful in Hashem's eyes among all the nations. Si'i loch be'ikve hatzoin, go out for yourself in the footsteps of the sheep, uri'ieth g'diyei sayich, and pasture your young goats. So al tikri gdiyosayich al gviyosayich. So don't read gdiyosayich, which means your goats, your young goats, but rather gviyosayich, meaning your bodies. Meaning, in other words, the pasuk therefore is hinting, if imloy sedi, if you don't pay attention to do the right thing to keep the Torah, then you're going to wind up having to follow the sheep of the ikrei atzayin, to follow the footsteps of the sheep or other animals, and to pasture your gviyosayich, your own body, meaning you yourself are going to have to be, as we have in the story over here, where she was collecting barley like that from among their, from between their feet and from among their dung. So again, it fits with what she herself had told Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, that she realizes that all of this was a consequence of that her father had not kept Torah, in particular the mitzvah of tzedakah, properly with either of the two explanations that we said, that he gave it for his covered or that he didn't give enough. Going back, by the way, we do see from the story, you know, we see the caliber of a yid in those days, that as much as bad off as she was, she had literally gone, you know, to use the Gemara's phrase, from a high roof, from the greatest heights of wealth down to this miserable degree of poverty. Still, she didn't complain. She recognized that Hashem does everything for a good reason, and she was even able to identify what it was exactly. That's no small thing.
It's amazing also that, but
letting you know that tzedakah has to be done yishma, and it has to be done within a
certain
amount.
Thing. So the Gemara is saying over here that you have to do it with lishma. So that's the thing. Maharsha distinguishes between two different kinds of lishma. There's shaloi lishma, where a person gives tzedakah, for example, the Gemara says elsewhere, kadesh yichya b'ni, in order that my son should live, or kadesh ezkel chaya adam abba, so I merit life in olam abba. That's shaloi lishma, but Maharsha is saying that's not as bad as a kind of shaloi lishma. The kind of shaloi lishma, which the Gemara is saying over here, that is not protective at all, is the kind where it's lakvoid. And again, we said the Chofetz Chaim says that maybe under normal circumstances, even that would be enough, but not at a time of Hashem's anger like the time of the Churban.
Fine, but yeah. Where does the Gemara take it?
That the Gemara is taking it because the Gemara knew, because the Chachamim knew. The Chachamim know these things.
What I was saying is that the fact also that he was ready to open up his fields before the Churban that's some serious.
No, one second. That wasn't his field. That was, remember, you're talking about that story with the 12 wells of water.
Besides, I'm talking about before the Churban, when they were the three or four rich people.
That he was ready to offer the whole place. Yeah. He was worth of food to the rest of the city. Well, that's true. It's true. It is a serious commitment. Yeah, you have the story in Gittin over there, where the three rich people, Nachman and Ben-Gurion being one of them, who were ready to offer 21 years worth of food that they should be able to survive the siege. Granted, I mean, maybe you could say also the fact is, you see, that in the end it didn't work out and it was all burnt, and nobody actually was, maybe that goes together with this, because all the years he had been giving tzedakah in a way that was lakvoida or inadequate or whatever. So now when he's offering to actually give a generous amount of tzedakah, then maybe Hashem arranged bashkacha pratis that it wouldn't actually happen. But we don't know. I mean, the point is we see from this Gemara, among other things, how strictly Hashem judges tzedakim, but we also can get an idea from this of the caliber of a yid in those days, that instead of complaining, and instead of she could have been blaming the Romans or the Biryonim or the this or the that or whatever, but she realized that ultimately everything comes from Hashem, and not to complain to him, but rather to accept his judgment. Okay, let's go back now to the matter of halacha in our Mishnah. So we described in our Mishnah and the previous Mishnah that when the amount of money that a woman brings in for her dowry gets, in many places, they would scale it up or down depending on various circumstances. We said there are three possibilities. If she brings in cash, money in the form of coinage, then we overvalue it when it's written in the ksuba. So if she brings in 1,000 zuz, for example, then the husband is taking on himself a responsibility that eventually, when he has to pay it back, if he dies before her, if he divorces her, if she dies and it has to go as ksubas benin dichrin, that's going to be inherited by his sons from her, then he's willing to pay 1,500. Because the idea is money is going to be invested. And therefore, so eventually over time, it's going to increase in value. On the other hand, we said, when it comes to kalim, then we said there are two possibilities. If the value of the kalim is known ahead of time, then we write shava b'shava. 100 is written down as 100, 1,000 is written down as 1,000. We don't increase and we don't deduct. if it was Kalim, where we don't know the value of them beforehand, and now when we're writing the Ksuba, we have to go and evaluate them, then we undervalue them by 20%, meaning that if she brings in 1,000, then the husband is taking responsibility for only 800. And we said a couple of reasons, one of them being because Kalim tend to depreciate over time, and another reason because to begin with, we want to have a larger amount in order to impress the people who are coming there for the wedding, but in fact, we're talking about things that are in fact objectively worth less. And so when it comes, in other words, in the chasana hole over there, we overvalue them. We end up valuing them at 1,000 in order that people should say, wow, she has such a big nadir. And then people will respect her more. But in fact, truly, they're only worth less than that. Okay. So now let's talk about some dinim regarding that. The Gemara says, Amar of Shaman Ba'aba Amar of Yechon. Hichnisa loy zahav. If she brings in, as a dowry, if she brings in gold, pieces of gold, in other words, Shaman Osei, then we evaluate the gold, we assess the value of the gold, Vahareo Kushabia, and it goes according to its value. We don't increase by the 50%, we don't deduct the 20%. We're not considering it like cash, we're considering it like the Talpin whose value was previously known. So the Gemara says, Mace, we have a contradiction. A Braisa says, Hazahob Hareu Kalim. Gold, the Braisa says, is like Kalim. Now, my love to Kalim shall test it. Doesn't that mean that we're comparing it to silver Kalim, the Pasi, where silver Kalim over time depreciate because you use them, and silver over time tarnishes and wears out and whatever. And that would mean that we should do the same minus 20%. And the answer is, like, not necessarily. Kalim shall Zahob, the like Pasi. No, the Braisa may be comparing it to Kalim of gold, which don't depreciate because gold doesn't tarnish or rust or anything. You don't use gold Kalim as often, so therefore they're not as likely to wear out. So that could be what the Braisa means. The Gemara says, you came to Kalim of gold. If that's what it meant, then the Braisa should be phrasing it, gold is like its Kalim, meaning Kalim made of the same material. So gold would be considered like Kalim made out of gold. Then the word kalim would make that clear. Kalim suggests that you value it like ordinary kalim, which do depreciate because they're used more often and they wear out. But oi, Tanya, furthermore, we learn in a braisa, zahav hareu kalim, gold is like kalim, dinere zahav, gold dinerim hareu kusafim, those are considered like money. In other words, so then you would value them at the actual value rather than, or even you'd increase the 50%. If she brought in 1,000 gold dinarim as a dowry, then the chosin would be taking responsibility for 1,500. By the way, Mordechai makes an interesting point. Why isn't that a problem of ribis? And he says, because the problem of ribis is basically when you have, because you're waiting a while for your payment, therefore you're getting paid extra. Here, you're not necessarily waiting. Suppose that they were to get divorced the next day, then already he's on the hook for the 1,500. So therefore, there's no aga neta, which means reward for an extra fee for waiting for your payment, which is the essence of what ribis is all about.
What's minimum waiting for ribis?
I'm saying, even if it was the same day, whatever. The point is, in other words, there's no real waiting. There's no real waiting, therefore the Mordechai says that can't be considered. But different other Mephoshim point out there's other considerations as well. Most of the time we're talking about this dowry is supplied by her father. He's not the loiva. The money is being paid. Let's put it this way: the money is coming from him. Eventually, it's being paid to his daughter. So therefore, it's not the ribis would be when the same person is borrowing money and then the same person is paying back more or whatever, or he's paying back to the same person. He was being paid
what
back.
In this case,
we're talking about the father of the kala is supplying the money.
Yeah.
And then the chassan eventually, when the marriage is over, is paying it to the daughter. So that's another reason why not to consider it ribis, because if he was repaying the father directly, then you might conceivably have a problem.
So we pay the first kid, the daughter.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Anyway. So the braisa continues. So we said that gold dinarim are considered like money. In other words, so we overvalue them by the 50%. But Reb Shimon Gamliel says, "B'makom shenagu shaloi l'perton," in places where they don't exchange gold dinarim for silver ones. In other words, where they do bit with it like this, you have usually the usual circulating money in those times in most places was silver. The Gemara mentions that in Bava Metzia and other places. So usually, if you had gold dinarim, you would have to exchange them for smaller denominations, for silver coins, before you could actually do business with them. It would be kind of the equivalent nowadays of, let's say, you know, if you have a $100 bill and you want to buy something from the store, you're going to have to, if you want to buy something worth a dollar from the store, not all stores are going to be willing to give you $99 a chain. Many of them are going to tell you, bring a smaller bill and then, yeah. So here would be a similar kind of thing. Now, in that case, you can't value them at their actual value because then you have to deduct the money changer's fee. When you change them, when you exchange them for silver coins, then you have to pay a fee for that. But it's sort of Shimon Gamliel saying that if gold dinarim are used as is in places for transactions, then Shimon Oser, then you evaluate them, then you assess their value, Vaharein Beshavyein. Then they go according to their actual value. Now, meaning not with the 50% in increase. So the question becomes, Reb Shimon Gamliel Ahei. So before we get to what we were talking about as far as gold pieces, let's first understand what part of the Braisa that Reb Shimon Gamliel is referring to with his statement. Ilema Asefa, is he talking about the Seifa of the Braisa, which said that gold dinarim are considered like ksofim, like coinage, like silver coinage. And Reb Shimon Gamliel says that's only that Reb Shimon Gamliel says that the in places where they use them as is, then they're not considered like coinage. Well, Mikal the Tanakama Sovra Afilu B'Makom Shinagus L'Lepartan. So what would the Tanakama hold regardless, even in places where they don't use gold dinarim for transactions because they're too expensive compared to what they're buying and selling in that place? How could you value them at their value? Well, enough. The fact is, you can't spend a gold dinner in such a place because nobody has changed for it. Ela lav ha-resha. Obviously, Reb Shimon Gamliel must be referring to the resha where it says zahav ha-reu ke-kelim. Gold is considered like kelim. V'hochi kamar. So therefore, the Braisa is saying zahav ha-reu ke-kelim. Gold, meaning pieces of gold, is considered like kelim. Namely, my kalim shall kesef. Namely, they're like silver kalim. So therefore, we would follow the usual rules for silver kalim, and either they're considered at their actual value, if the value of them is known ahead of time, or we would undervalue them by 20% if we're figuring out the value in the chasana hole over there. And then, Reb Shimon Gamliel, how do you put dinner and shall zahav, the makam shenagu shalai l'perta. And Reb Shimon Gamliel says that no, we consider gold like gold, pieces of gold to be like gold dinarim in places where they don't have to exchange them, in places where they can use gold dinarim as is, because they're, it's a wealthy area and people use actual gold dinarim as a medium of exchange, then gold pieces, Reb Shimon Gamliel says, would have the same rule. The point being, in other words, that if we understand the Braisa that way, then the Tanakama would be saying that pieces of gold count like silver kalim. So silver kalim are undervalued by 20% when you come to write silver. How can Reb Shimon Ba'aba be telling us in the name of Reb Yechanan that Hareyu Kishavyoi, that we give it its actual value rather than undervaluing or overvaluing it? So the answer is loy, not necessarily. You could say la'olam ha'sefer. You don't have to understand the machlokas of the Tanakama and Reb Shimon Gamliel that way. You could say that Reb Shimon Gamliel is in fact referring to the sefer. And so the question is, so what do you mean? Does the Tanakama hold that gold dinarim always are considered at their actual value? What about in places where you can't spend a gold dinar because nobody has that kind of change? Don't you need to first take it to a money changer and then you have to pay him his fee for that? So no, udenafi ayad chak. The answer is, we're talking about a place where they don't circulate as easily, but you can find people who will accept them. So you'll yell at Doichek, but you can find somebody. So now, the machlokas is as follows. Mar Sovar, the Tanakama holds that Kivin de Nafti, since they do after all circulate, even if with difficulty, Meshabchinan law, so therefore we have to consider them like Kalim, where they're overvalued compared to what's written in the Ksuba, meaning, in other words, where 1,000 dinar of them becomes 800 in the Ksuba. Omar Saba, Kivin de Nafti, Ela Adiyat Fak, Loi Meshabchinan law, and Reb Shimon Gamliel hold, the fact is they're only circulating Ela Adiyat Fak, so therefore we should consider them more. Therefore, Shimon Gamliel says, "The Mokam Shenagu Shaloi LePerton, where the regular minhag is not to exchange them, then you can say they count like money. But in a place where most people would in fact have to exchange them, then you wouldn't. Then you would consider them like cable.
So then you could say that the Tanakhama would, so then the Tanakhama is not necessarily saying that pieces of gold, meaning not gold coins, but pieces of gold are, we said that he started by saying Hareyu Kalim, and we're arguing if we, and we're arguing that maybe he means that they're always considered like Kalim, and Rabbi Gamliel says it depends whether gold is used as a medium of exchange, as currency in this place. Now we say it doesn't necessarily have to be that. They can be arguing only on the Sefer, and in the Reisha, the Tanakhama would be saying Zahav Hareyu Kalim, which would mean, therefore, that we, so we would consider them, so we would consider them like Kalim rather than like, rather, so we'd consider that those gold pieces like Kalim. So again, if we knew the value of them beforehand, and gold is easy enough to assess the value of before they ever come to the Chasana Hall, then it would be at its, then it would be at its actual value. Only if for whatever reason we had to assess it in the Chasana Hall, then we deduct the 20%. The Iboisema, or another possibility, you could say about the Braisa, Kulur of Shimon Gamliel. Before we get to that, by the way, so now Rashi again had said that we're talking about pieces of gold. The whole discussion over here is about pieces of gold. Tosfos actually has a different explanation that to begin with, when he said, we don't mean pieces of gold. What we actually mean is, for example, gold jewelry, rings or things like that. So then Tosfos learns the sugya somewhat differently. That the Gemara first thought we should consider them like silver kalim, because unlike most gold kalim, which are not used very often, gold jewelry is going to be worn. So therefore, fine, it doesn't wear out, because gold doesn't wear out, but nevertheless, because she uses them on an ongoing basis, wouldn't that be reason enough that we should accept that the chosen can deduct 20%? Because she's getting the benefit of the fact that she's using them, she's wearing them all the time, and then decorating herself with them all the time. And the answer is that no, the Gemara wanted to say that no, we should consider them like other kinds of gold kalim which aren't used as often, for example, cups or whatever. It's true that when they're used, they do wear out over time, but because they're gold, you use them less. And then according to that, the Gemara is going back and forth over here about that. But according to Tosfos, the discussion over here is not about random pieces of gold, but rather about gold kalim of the kind, for example, like jewelry, which are going to see constant use.
And what we learned to the Gemara yet? Those days, the women barely went outside.
You know? No, I wouldn't say that they barely went outside. I mean, if nothing else, they went, first of all, even if they may not have gone outside into the street, but they went out in their chotzer, for example, so their neighbors would see. No, they still, right, in the chotzer, they might well be wearing jewelry.
Well,
they might. So, but even so, I mean, also, if they do happen to be in the street for whatever reason, then yeah. Okay. So then the Gemara says, Iboyisema, another way you could understand it, Kulur of Shimon Gamliel. You could say there's no real machlokes in the Braisa, but rather the Tanakhama is Rav Shimon Gamliel. The Chsuri Mechsura, we would say the Braisa is missing a phrase, but Hochi Katani. Now we could understand rather the Braisa as follows. Zahav Harel Kekalim, gold, again, according to Rashi, random pieces of gold, according to Tosfos, gold jewelry, is considered like kalim, meaning like silver kalim or whatever, and therefore the usual 20% undervaluing takes place. Bamed gonamam dinure zahav, on the other hand, gold dinurim, which are actual coins, hare and kitsafim, then they're considered like money, and therefore we would overvalue them by 50%. The chosin would accept on himself that he's going to eventually pay 50% more. Bamed gonamam murim, when would that be talking about? He was the phrase of the braisa that would be missing to make it all go according to the Shem Namil. But Mokam Shenagul Aparchan, in places where the local minhag is that you have to exchange gold dinarim before you can use them, because you can't use them as is, because nobody has that kind of change. Abu Mokam Shenagul Shalol Aparchan, but in places where they don't have the minhag to exchange them, you can use them as is, because the people there are wealthy. Then Shaman Osam Varein Veshav Yehen, then we evaluate them and they go according to their actual value, because then they can be used as is. Dibrit of Shimon Gamliel, that would be what Rav Shimon Gamliel says. Sher of Shimon Gamliel Omer, and we would clarify that Rav Shimon Gamliel is saying, B'mokam Shanagu Shalol Aparchan, in places where they don't have to exchange gold dinarim, where they can use them as is, Shaman Osan, then we evaluate them B'harein B'shav Yehen, and they go according to their actual value, because there's no need to deduct anything. Okay, nevertheless, the Gemara says, if you're going to understand it that way, love me, by the way. We still have the same problem that we had before when we started with this braisa, that if the braisa meant to compare gold pieces or gold jewelry to other kinds, to gold kalim, then the word should have been kalim, that gold is like its kalim, meaning like kalim made from gold itself. instead of kelim, which would mislead us to mean that it means a different kind of kelim. Okay, kasha, the Gemara says, fine, according to that, that would be a kasha. A third possibility, you could say, you could say, you know what kind of gold we're talking about over here? We're talking about broken gold, which means, so Rashi, who said before that we were talking about pieces of gold, he says now we're talking about small pieces of, very small pieces of gold, like almost like dust or something. So the point is, at least large gold pieces, when you handle them, nothing of them gets lost. Smaller, if you have like gold dust or something and you're handling it, some of it is going to fall away and get lost. So therefore, over time, gold doesn't really depreciate per se, but as you handle it, then some of it is inevitably going to get lost, and therefore we could say that you consider it like kelim and you undervalue it. Tosfos, who before learned that we're talking about gold jewelry, would say we could even be talking about now large pieces of gold. Gold jewelry at least has a reasonably defined value because you know the value of the jewelry as opposed to random pieces of gold. You have to start weighing them and figuring out how much they're worth. Tosfos says the other way around. Sorry, I said that wrongly. That broken pieces of gold, the fact is they don't depreciate, therefore we would count them like kelim. Therefore, we would count them like kelim. In other words, we have kelim where the value is known ahead of time, and therefore we don't have to deduct. Rav Ashi Amar b'mamwa. Rav Ashi says another answer. We could be talking about mamwa. So here, Rashi explains dava pricha means smaller pieces. Mamwa means even smaller. So sorry, I said that wrong. Mamwa would be like gold dust. The previous one, dava pricha, would be smaller pieces where it's easy for them to get lost as you're handling them. The mamla would be even more than that, where it's gold dust, so like it sticks to things and whatever, and therefore, very likely some of it is going to be lost over time. Tosfos rather explains that mamla means gold ore. So it hasn't even been refined yet. It's gold as it comes out of the ground, where it's mixed with various minerals and all, and you have to refine it in order to get a certain amount of gold out of it. So that would be the kind that we say counts like kelim, because when you refine it, it's going to depreciate because you only have only a certain amount of it is gold, and the rest of it is the rest of it is various kinds of service. Yeah. Okay. More on this topic. Amr of Yanai, Besamim Shalan Tuchya Harein Kiksopim. The spices that they sell in Antiochia. Antiochia is the city of Antioch in the north of Syria. It was actually founded by Antiochus' ancestor, Seleucus, when he founded his empire. It became their capital city, and for hundreds of years it was a very important city in the area. So now, in that city, the main business that everybody in that city, or not everybody, that many people in that city engaged in was buying and selling spices. So therefore, in a place like that, Harem Kiksafim, such things count like money, and therefore because what are we saying? Money can be spent, and the husband can invest it. And therefore, we're expecting that he, over time, he's going to turn a profit on it, and therefore we overvalue it when it's written in the Ksuba by 50%. So now we're saying, in Antiochia, if a woman gets married over there, and she brings in to the dowry, she brings in the sum in, then also the chosin accepts a 50% increase in that for the same reason, because he expects that it's almost like a normal medium of exchange over there. They use it in Antiochia almost as if it was money. And therefore it can be considered like money in that regard. Similarly, Amr of Shmuel ben Nachmeni, Amr of Yechanan, Gmalim shal Arvia, camels in Arabia, there were Jews living in Arabia in those times, and camels, and everybody over there had camels. So therefore, such things, Isha Goyva Pauna Mehen, the woman can collect Pauna from them. Now Rashi explains Pauna means the extra one third, or really in terms that we've been talking, this one half. Meaning again, if she brings in, for example, two camels, then the husband is accepting on himself that eventually, when it has to be paid out, that he'll pay three camels. Again, the idea being everybody in Arabia had camels, and therefore that was the equivalent of bringing in money or something like that, where we overvalue it by one third. Tosfos has a different explanation. That pauna, the Tosfos says, in that case, he should have used the word harein kiksafim. He should have used the same expression as Rabbi Yanai uses. Rather, Tosfos says what it means is, when it comes to collecting the ksuba, now normally, medina de gemara, a woman can collect her ksuba only from karka, unless the husband specifically designated certain metaltlin that she's going to collect from, as we've touched on before, and we're going to talk in more detail in later parakim of Amasechta, then normally when she comes to collect her ksuba after her husband died, then she's only entitled to collect from karka. But here we're saying, in Arabia, she can also collect some camels, because everybody had camels over there, and therefore there's a smichas das, therefore she has a mental knowledge that the Yoshim will always have camels, the same way as in any place else, you could expect the Yoshim will always have camels.
As a car.
As a, yeah, the equivalent nowadays might be like a car or something, right. Now, Tosfos goes on to say that eventually the Gaonim made a takana. We've talked about it before. Eventually, in the middle of the time of the Gaonim, they made a takana that it, always a woman can collect her ksuba from the Talmud. And the reason was, we talked about, because there came a point in Jewish history when most Jews didn't own land anymore. The Goyish rulers were imposing high taxes on non-Muslims or non-Christians or whatever who own land. So most Jews... In Babel, it was the Muslims. I'm saying they're the Goyish rulers. In Babel, it was the Muslims. And we're talking after the time of the Gemara. We're talking about the time of the Goyish. So in Babel, the Muslims came up, and in other places where Jews lived that were under Muslim rule, they had a concept, they came up with a law that said that non-believers, meaning non-Muslims who own land, have to pay much higher than normal taxes. And the same thing in Christian countries, they did the same thing again. So therefore,
they have to pay more taxes,
more land taxes, yeah. So the point is, it came a point in history when it was uneconomical for your average Jew to own land. You see nowadays, I mean, if a person owns a house, then they own land, but it wasn't, in the time of the Gemara, the expectation was that everybody owns a field, and they grow their own crops. Nowadays, that's very uncommon. So that all began in that period. So anyway, so the Gaonim made a takana about 1200 years ago, saying that the ksuba can be collected from the Talmud. So Tosfos relates that, so Tosfos starts by relating that to our Gemara over here, the same way as we're saying that in Arabia everybody had camels, the same way the Gaonim are making the Takana, given that not necessarily everybody has land, but everybody has Metalplin, then you can collect from that. Rabbi Natam actually doesn't really like that equation, because he says, after all, the fact is, if the husband sells the Metalplin, then the woman can't collect from them, unlike with land, where if the husband sells it, there's a shibboleth on it. So fine, there's the Takana of the Gaonim. It's partially based on this Gemara, but not exclusively. It's more based on that, the Rambam actually says, by the way, when it comes to collecting ksuba, we do have to know whether the husband was aware of this Takana at the time, otherwise the Takana of the Gaonim is not strong enough to bind the husband. If it was something from the Gemara, then we say everybody has to follow what it says in the Gemara, whether they know about it or not. When a person marries, he's doing Kedas Moshe Yisrael, but Takana of the Gaonim, the Rambam says, not necessarily. The Rambam says, on the other hand, later on, after that Takana, Chachamim came up with the concept that in the Ksuba, we explicitly write that the husband is accepting on himself a shibud on everything that he owns, including the Talmud, afilu miglima da'al kasfoi, we write in the Ksuba, even the shirt off my back. Then, once we have that written in the Ksuba, the Rambam says, that was great, Chachamim came up with that idea. Because now, when the wife comes to collect the Ksuba, it's not, we don't have to say, well, did you know of the Takana of the Gaonim or not? You yourself wrote in the Ksuba that you're accepting a Shibud voluntarily on your Metalpilin. And therefore, that can work. Okay. Going on, the Gemara says, Amar Apapi, similar things that are considered like, these are the known Metalpilin that people have in a certain place. Hani Toisvi Deme Michsi, the dresses from Bay Michsi, the name of the place, same thing. It's everybody had those kinds of dresses, and they did business with them. Isha gave a pound in her hand, so therefore a woman can collect her pound from that. According to Rashi, the extra 50%, and according to Tosfos, that she can collect her ksuba from them. Similarly, Va'amara Papi, Hani Saki de Rudia, the sacks of a place called Rudia, which again, that was everybody in that place was involved in making and buying and selling these sacks. The Ashli de Kimchunya and the ropes of Kimchunya, also, Isha Goyva Pound in my hand, also the same rules apply. Now, Omar Rava, so Rava says in this connection, Meresh Havamina, I used to think, Hani Aunaki de Mechuza, the purses full of money of Mechuza, I thought also Isha Goyva Pound in my hand, that the woman can collect her pound from them. Now, Rashi says here, he agrees with what Tosfos says, that we're talking about collecting from Nichsa Yisoyim. Normally we say Metalpilin and Yisoyim are not under a shibud to pay off any of their father's debts, only their karka, which is why, until the Tekonis of Gaonim, a woman could collect only from karka. But Rava thought to say that in Mechuza, since everybody uses these purses of money all the time as a medium of exchange, we don't just mean the coins inside them, of course, everybody does that. We mean the actual purses themselves. Like it was a standard thing, I'll pay you X number of purses or whatever. So he thought the same thing, a woman could collect her ksuba from them because she has an asmachta, because she knows that everybody has such things in Mechuza. So at first, Rava says, I used to think that. My time, asmachtayu alayu. Because a person has a smichus das on them, he knows, why is it that you can collect from karka? Because you know, everybody has karka, and even if he doesn't have it at the time, he sold it, nevertheless, you still know where it is. So I thought that these persons are the same thing. Kiven the chazoi, but then Rava says, I saw, the shakli lahu benafti. What happens when a woman, what happens when an amana collects her ksuva using these purses? She takes the money and goes out, and as soon as they find some land to buy, then they use these purses to buy land. Aminas, and now Rava says, I realize, fundamentally, those smichus das is on the land, not so much on the purses, and therefore the purses are still considered metalflin, are still considered like regular metalflin. She can't collect those from the assignment. She can collect only karka, because we see that she herself, as soon as she has the opportunity, will use those purses to buy karka. As opposed to, now with the other things, not necessarily, we're not saying, for example, that as soon as a person, that as soon as a Jewish woman in Arabia gets camels, she's right away going to sell those and buy land, not necessarily, so therefore the din can still apply with those things. Because you can use the actual camels, yeah, and the same thing with the other things. Okay. Mishnah says, continuing on the topic of what the father provides for his daughter, before we were talking about in terms of a nadin, now let's talk about the actual wedding expenses. The Mishnah says, Hamasias bitoy stam, a man marries off his daughter stam without any specification of how much he's going to provide for wedding expenses and a nadin and whatever. Lo yifchis lo mechamishim zuz. He should not give her less than 50 zuz of wedding expenses. And posek lach nisa aruma. What if the arrangement was made? The husband knows he's marrying a wife from a poor family. So he knows her father can't really afford anything. So therefore, so the deal was, they arranged as the arrangements that the father is not going to provide any clothes at all. Aruma means undressed. Doesn't literally mean, obviously, she's not going to go to the chuppah undressed. What it means is, in other words, that the father is not pledging to supply any clothes for her. Whatever clothes so the father is saying that the father will borrow clothes from somebody and she'll go to them, she'll go to the chasana that way, and then afterwards she'll have to return them. So lo yomer abal, the husband cannot say once she comes into my house, then I'll provide her with clothing. As we learned in the previous parak that a husband has to provide his wife with clothing.
No.
He has to supply the clothing while she's still in her father's house. So instead of making her or her father having to go and borrow clothes, or she'll just wear whatever ragged clothing she's wearing, no, the husband has to supply her with clothes already before the wedding, when they're about to go to the wedding.
You know what?
Similarly, the Mishnah continues, if we're marrying off a Yisoma, so a Gabbai Tzedakah who's responsible for supporting the Yisomim in town, so if he's marrying off a Yisoma, lo yifchis l'machamishim zuz, again, he should supply her with not less than 50 zuz worth of clothing and other wedding expenses. Im yesh bakis, and if there is enough money in the tzedakah pushka, mefaunis in oisa l'fi kvoida, then we supply her according to her kavod, meaning we look at whether her kavod, if she's, for example, a yisoma from a family that used to be rich and now became poor, then we have to supply her more than 50 zuz in accordance with the kavod that her family would have expected. So the Gemara says, Amar Abai, chamishim zuzi pshiti. When we say 50 zuz in our Mishnah for the father, or for the Gabbai Tzedakah, we mean 50 zuzi pshiti, where we learned in the previous parak that they had two kinds of monetary systems in those days. You had Kesef Tzori, which is money from Tzur, the city of Tzur in the north of Eretz Yisrael, nowadays it's in Lebanon. That was a big trading center. Their coinage was more or less pure silver. So therefore, dinner there was worth a dinner, and a sella was worth a sella, and so forth. Then you had what was called Kesef Medina, the money that was coined in the country of Eretz Yisrael, where it was one-eighth of that. One-eighth of the coin would be silver, and the other seven-eighths would be copper. They still called it the same denomination. So, for example, a dinar, so they'd mint a coin in Eretz Yisrael and call it a dinar, but it would be worth only one-eighth of a dinar of tzur. So now, when we're saying 50 zuz, a zuz is another word for a dinar, what we mean is 50 of those Eretz Yisrael zuz. In terms of kesef tzori, which is usually what we use throughout Shas, for money, then it's one-eighth of that. So therefore, instead of 50, it comes to 6 1/4. And the Gemara says, Mimai, how do we know that? Midkatani Seifa. Because after all, the Mishnah continues, Im yesh bekis mefaunis in oisa l'fi kvoda. We said, if there is enough money in the pushka, then we provide for her according to her kavod. Vaminan, and we explain my kiss, what peace do we mean? Omarach va'arniki shel tzedakah, I mean the purse of tzedakah, where tzedakah is being collected and distributed from, the tzedakah fund. Now, the sakadaitim, chamishim zuzim mamish, if you thought it literally meant 50 zuzim, where if you think of it, 200 zuz, we said before, is the amount that a person could live on for a year. So 200 zuz would be the equivalent of a quarter of a person's expenses for a year. How much already would we be giving her if there is that much in the pushka? You can't expect to spend the entire amount in the pushka on one wedding. So obviously, therefore, we have to be talking about 6 zuzi pshiti, which is only 6 1/4 regular dinarim. So fine, if the average person, we said yesterday, the average person might earn 4 dinar a day, 4 dinar 30 a day, that is. So therefore, so 6 1/4 would be a day and a half's worth of wages for minimum wage labor. That's not so much. That's not going to deplete the kis shok staka such that we would have a problem. That's what we say. Chamishim zuzim means chamishim zuzim pshit. We don't mean 50 regular zuzim, meaning in other words, you're talking a quarter of what a person could live on for a year, rather we're scaling that down by 1/8. So therefore, it's the equivalent of what a person could, live on for about 3 weeks. In terms of wages, it would be about a day and a half or so's worth of wages. So that's not too much. That's not going to complete the kiss shel tzedakah. The Shittim Kovetzis explains the reason why the Gemara had to first bring that the kiss means arniki shel tzedakah is because if we were going to say that kiss means the specific fund set aside for marrying off Yisoimim and Yisoimus, then maybe it's not so unreasonable to spend a large amount. But now that we're saying it means the general kiss shel tzedakah, the general tzedakah fund, which is used for weddings, but it's also used to provide for people for Shabbos and Yom Tov and for the week. And also for all kinds of other needs of the poor, then you can't expect to spend 50 zuz of it just on one wedding. Okay, so now this brings us into some discussion about tzedakah. Tanan Rabbanan, yosim b'yisayma shabohu l'ispanis. If a boy, a yosin, and a girl, a yisayma, come to the gabbai tzedakah, that they both need to be supported with tzedakah, mefanis in a yisayma, v'achakach mefanis in a yosin. First we supply the yisayma, the girl, and then the boy. Because a boy, it's usual for him to go and beg by the doors. If he has to go beg for tzedakah, it's not such a humiliation for him. For a girl, it's a much greater humiliation. Now, on the other hand, though, there is a Mishnah in Hurdius that says that when it comes to supporting, when it comes to providing food, then a man comes ahead because he has more mitzvahs. So how does that fit with over here? So there's a few different explanations. One is that we're talking about over here, we're not talking about food so much as clothing or other kinds of expenses like that. Another point, actually it says over there, that you provide for a girl first anyway for a different reason. Her embarrassment and wearing inadequate clothing is greater than for a boy. But another interesting idea that Rishonim bring over here is we're not talking about the mefanesin over here. It doesn't mean to supply them with food and clothing for day-to-day needs, but rather to supply them for their wedding. So then an interesting explanation is, ha'ish darke lachzer, a man will look for a shidduch. Meaning he found himself a girl that he wants to marry. If they're not able to supply him with enough for the wedding, and therefore she ends up calling it off, fine, it won't be so hard for him to go again on shidduchim and find somebody else. Whereas a isha in darke lachzer, if someone finds her and wants to marry her, and now she doesn't have enough money, and he's going to say, you know what, forget about it, I'll find somebody else, she may have a much harder time finding a husband because she's anyway not going and looking for shidduchim. So that would be another explanation of why she gets precedence.
Yeah. It also might look bad that she's mivatul this shidduch and she's
maybe
for another one.
Could be, yeah. And the braisa continues. Yosim v'yisoma shaboli nase. If both a yosim and a yisoma are coming to get married, we don't mean to each other. We mean each of them are coming. Each of us has a shidduch, and we need help with our wedding expenses. Masiyin say yisoma v'achakach masiyin say yosim. First we marry off the yisoma, we help her with the wedding expenses, and then the yosim. Because a woman's humiliation is greater than a man's, and that includes not only the humiliation of having to beg, but also again the humiliation of remaining unmarried. It's a much bigger burden on the woman than it is for the man.
And I'm seeing the expenses great because she has to come and stickle not in
Well, maybe. I mean, the chassan may be willing to accept her without an adam, but yeah, there is that consideration as well. Okay, Tananabam. Yosem Shabal Lisa, when a Yosem comes to get married, and the Gabor Tzedakah are going to be supplying him what he needs for the wedding, Sochrin Lebayis, first they rent him a house to live in, or Matsiyim Lemitim B'chol Klei Tashmisha, they provide for him a bed and all the other furniture and things and things that he needs, V'achakach Matsiyim Leisha. Then they help him get married. We find in the Gemara in Sota, for example, where it says a similar idea. It says that a person should first have a place to live, and a vineyard. Yeah, but Amman brings in a Hufzdeus. A person should have a place to live, and then he should have a vineyard or something like that that he can earn money from, and then get married. And Amman says, as opposed to, for example, foolish people do the other way around. But yeah.
But here it's Sochrin, it's not Balut.
Right. So same, well, if they can buy him a house cheaply, well, fine.
But if he doesn't have a girl for the next 2 months, he's paying rent for nothing.
Yeah, but he's still living over there. He's a Sochrin Lebayis, means they're still living or they're renting a place to live. And the reason is because the pasuk says day machser day asher yachsalo. The pasuk says you have to supply him with everything that's needed for his lack that he lacks. So what do these expressions mean? Day machser day zehabayis, when it says to provide for what he's missing, for what he's lacking, zehabayis, that refers to a house, which is an extremely important thing for a person. Asher yachsalo, when it says that he's lacking, zemit of a shulchan, that means a bed and a table and other things like that. Loi, and when it says Asher Yesa Loi, the word Loi means Zu Isha. That refers to a wife. V'chein Loi Me'esa Loi is a connector. We find Hashem uses the expression Loi in connection with Adam that I'll create chapter. So let's talk more about that pasuk. Tanan Abanan, when it says Dei Machsoda, you have to provide him as much as he's lacking. That means after Mitzvah of the Lefanesai, you have a mitzvah to support him, to give him food and clothing and whatever. The after Mitzvah of the Ashrei. You're not obligated to give a person so much tzedakah to actually make him rich. And when it says Asher Yech Saloi, when it says what he's lacking, that means Afilu Sus Lurkov Olav Eved Loritz Lefanov, even you have to supply him a horse to ride on and an Eved to run in front of him, if that's what he used to be used to, if he was used to be rich and now he's poor. So he was used to that in his previous life, so then you have to supply that for him. The Shittim Kobetis brings from the Gaonim that say this is only when people don't know yet that he's poor. Once it becomes well known that he's poor, then you're not obligated to supply these things anymore. But at least as long as people don't know, then his dignity was to go like that, then you have to supply it. But there was a cute story involving the Kotzker in this connection where one time this guy visits him, and the Kotzker treats him with great derecheret and a rebbe and everything, even though every now and then the Chassidim knew that the Kotzker doesn't hold much of this guy, but still, so they asked him why. He says, look at our Gemara over here. Sus Lurkov Olav, I can understand. What if the guy can't walk well? He's weak or whatever. But Eved Loritz Lefanov, I mean, that's Stam a Shtus. So you see from that that even to provide the Shtus for a Shoita is also, when he feels that he deserves it, is also a Shtikl Tzedakah. Omru Olav Al Hilol Azakin, in fact, they said about it. The Rebbe once addressed this in a Sikha, actually. The Rebbe was talking about one time about the mitzvah of lending money to a Yid, and the Rebbe made the point over there, a similar point, that it's not just when the person needs it for his basic necessities, even when you have something, which to you it might be considered a luxury, but to him he feels he can't do without it, then it's also a chesed, it's also a gmilas chesed to lend him money for that. And the Gemara says, Omru Olav Al Hilol Azakin, Shalokach La'oni Ben Tovimach. What had happened once, that Hilol were bought for a certain poor person who had come from a well-to-do family, and he bought him Susler Kervoli, he bought him a horse to ride on, the Eved Loritz Lefanov, and he bought him an Eved to run in front of him. And the point of the Eved running in front, by the way, is he would announce, clear the way, this guy is coming. You find, for example, it says by Eliyahu HaNavi that he ran in front of Achav's chariot for the same purpose. Yeah, Achav the Rosha, So you have after the story over there of Eliyahu about a Carmel, it says over there that now he showed Achav a certain kavod, which from that we learn that you show kavod to a king, even if not deserving, and so and since nobody else was available, everybody had run home, but it's about to start raining, then Achav himself ran in front of Achav's chariot to announce that he's coming. And the Braisa continues, Pam Achas Loimotze Eved Loritz Lefanov. One time Hillel was not able to find an Eved who could run in front of the guy, Loritz Lefanov, Shlosha Milan. So Hillel himself ran in front of the guy for 3 million. Then Yehoyada says, though, it's possible that Hillel put on a disguise or something, because otherwise it would be a lack of Derech Eretz for the Nasi to be doing that. There's even an opinion in the Gemara Kedushin, although the Halacha is not like that, that a Nasi can't be Mochel on his cupboard. So you would have to say that maybe he disguised himself so nobody realizes. More on this topic, since we're talking about supporting Amim, it happened once with the people of the Upper Galil, which is the area of Tzfas and Miron and the other mountainous areas of Galil. So they bought on behalf of a poor person, again, who was a Ben Tovim. He had come from a well-to-do family, and now he was poor, so from Tzipori. So they brought him litra basa b'chol yom. They brought him a litra, which is about a pound of meat every day. So he must have litra basa, ma'ira basa. What's a big chiddush? That's a normal amount a person might eat. A litra basa mishal oifas. It means it was bird meat, which in those days was more expensive than animal meat. So therefore, so it means they're spending extra on him again, because this was what he was used to in his former life, and therefore they continued supplying that to him. The buys him a bilitra basa manch. Another possibility is we don't mean that they bought him a litra of meat. We mean they spent a litra of coins to buy him meat, which is a huge amount. But again, that was what he was used to before, so therefore that's what they got. Rav Ashi says a third answer. What happened was this guy was living in a small village. So there aren't that many people. When you shecht an animal, there's not that many people available to buy the meat. They couldn't refrigerate it because they didn't have refrigeration. So therefore, so every day they're having to lose out an animal because of him. They're shechting an animal and they're providing him with his litter of meat. But what's happening with the rest of the meat? There's not enough people available to buy it. So it's going to go to waste. Nevertheless, they consider that worthwhile for this oni ben tovim. Somebody once pointed out to me an interesting thing. I think it was actually one of the members of the Shir years ago, that this helps give you an idea of why Avram and Achai, what is Avram and Achai doing in the Shev Mitzvah Menayach? The answer is, given this kind of thing, that if you want a small amount of meat, you have to shecht an entire animal, the goyim in those times, what would they do? So they wouldn't shecht the animal. They would cut off a piece of it. The animal is still alive. The rest of it will be preserved for another time. And then they have meat available. So therefore, the Torah is telling you you're not allowed to do that. It happened once that a poor person came to Reb Nechemia. Reb Nechemia asked him, what do you usually eat for a meal? So the guy says, I usually eat fat meat and old wine, which is, of course, very expensive. So Reb Nechemia says, do you want to try to manage with me eating lentils? Because Reb Nechemia himself was poor and that's all he could afford. So the guy tried to manage eating lentils together with Reb Nechemia, but he died from it. Omar, so Reb Nechemia says, woe to this person that Nechemia killed me. What's the expression? Shouldn't he be saying, woe to Nechemia, to myself, that I caused this person to be killed? The answer is no. He meant exactly what he said. This poor person shouldn't have been that finicky. He should have been willing to accept, you know what, I'm not rich anymore. I don't need this meat and wine. I can learn to live with less. And the fact that he didn't learn to live with less, that's his problem. So Mephoshim discussed a considerable amount, and we're saying the Oni himself should try to do that. When he can't, as we're going to have the next story, for example, then you supply him what we said before, like, for example, the poor person of Tzipori, who they supplied with a litter of also, because he couldn't manage otherwise. It would affect his health or whatever. But here, Reb Nechemia figured that the guy is just being finicky.
Slowly
you can do it, yeah. And another example, the Gemara says, Ahuja Osala Kameda Rabba, a poor person once came to Rabba, Omalai Bamaka Sayyid, so Rabba asked him, what do you usually eat? Omalai, and the man says, Batanagurlis Tuma Vayayan Yoshin, I eat a fattened chicken and old wine. Again, we just said chicken in those days was more expensive than animal meat. So Rabba tells him, like, Chaishas Leduchka de Tzibura, aren't you concerned about the burden on the Tzibura that they should have to be providing you that so much every day? So the poor man answers, what do you think? Do you think I'm eating from what's theirs? What I'm eating is provided by Hashem. The Tanena, as we learn in the Braisa, that the Pasuk says, the eyes of everybody look towards you, and you provide them their food in his time. Now, Ochlam is in plural, so why is Be'itoi in the singular? It means, Be'itam le'nemer ela be'itoi. So Braisa says, doesn't say be'itam in their time, ela be'itoi in his time. Melamed shekalach abecha, noisen HaKadosh Baruch Hu panasasi be'itoi. Each person Hashem provides his parnasa in his time, when he needs it. So therefore, this is I need. Now Marsha says, in order not to contradict the previous story, we have to say, the guy's not saying every time, every day, that's what I eat. He's saying, there are times when I feel my health requires it, and this is one of those times. So you're saying duch b'desibura, but the fact is, I understand that Hashem provides for a person. He had b'tochen and Hashem, and right now that's what I need for my health, and therefore Hashem is going to supply it to me somehow. So the Gemara continues, Adahofi, as they were discussing this, Asoi Achse de Rabba, Rabba's sister came for a visit. She hadn't seen Rabba, her brother, for 13 years. And she brought him a present. And a fatted chicken and old wine. Omar, so Rabba says to himself, my Dakoma, what's this in front of us? In other words, this is tremendous. Hashgacha brought this, that she should show up Davka today, and that she should bring Davka such a present. Omale, so he says to the poor man, Na nesi loch, I've spoken too much against you. Kum echoyo, come sit and eat. So he realized, in other words, that the guy was right. The person has betocha, and then Hashem Taka supplies what he needs at the time. So we'll continue. We'll continue on this topic of tzedakah and the ins and outs of it tomorrow. Best.
Oh, wow. So high.